helping to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. This is the Constitution Study on the America Out Loud Network with your host, Paul Engel. Public schools had an honorable start in this country. See, first, people taught their children at home because, well, that was the only option. The communities would sometimes get together and they'd pool their resources and they'd build a schoolhouse and they'd hire a teacher. But you see, then it was agreed that it was a public responsibility to make sure that every child had a basic education, the chance to learn to read, write, do basic math, and, of course, basic civics. See, it was agreed that public taxes would be used to build and operate local schools overseen by the parents to make sure every child had this opportunity. Somewhere along the line, though, things seem to have gone horribly wrong. But before we can decide how to react to this problem, we have to identify what the problem is. Next, we have to decide what we want public education to be, and only then can we figure out what to do next. Hello there, everyday Americans. Paul Engel here with the Constitution Study, where we read and study the Constitution. And we teach the rising generation to be free. I am so glad you could join me today. You know, the idea for today's episode came from an article I found by a Cruz Marquis. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, and I do apologize. But apparently he writes at theconservativecritique.com, and he posed what I thought would be an interesting question. He states that it's time to separate school and state. Now, of course, I'm sure you've all heard of the separation of church and state, but this was an idea that I thought was intriguing. And in looking at the article, he talks about how, as I said, we use taxes to fund the schools because we thought the education was important. But as the state, as government has gotten more and more involved, they, of course, want to not only monopolize education, but they want to monopolize the what is taught. I'm reminded of a quote from Vladimir Lenin. Give me your four-year-olds, and in a generation, I will build a socialist state. Considering that we started at the age of five with education, and now, if you're talking about kindergarten and preschool, you're talking 4 years old. We hand our children over to the state to be educated, and I have to say, it's not working very well. Now, there's a reason why my wife and I agreed that we would not send our daughter to public school. We thought private school might be an option, but we really thought that homeschooling was the best. And there were several reasons for that. And I understand not everybody can make that decision. Not everybody has the same priorities, has the same skills, has the same opportunities. But I want to get back to this idea of separation of education and state. Mr. Marquis says in his article, he says, by removing the state from education, a number of things will happen. The absolute size of the behemoth will shrink. Teachers' unions will have less power over the students' educational continuity. Different sorts of education will be offered. And Christians, rightists, libertarians, anti-statists, and free thinkers will not be forcibly subject to the state's propaganda. I like that idea. I like it very much. And I'd be curious to find a way of how do we separate education and state, but still make sure that education doesn't become something only for an aristocracy, a ruling class, or something along those lines. So this is something I want to consider. But as I said in the opening, before we figure out where we're going, we got to know where we are. Before we can solve a problem, we have to know what that problem is. Now, I know a lot of people that will identify a lot of individual problems with the public school system or public education system. I've identified many of them, but I think we need to go deeper. We need to go to the source. We need to look and see if there's a fundamental flaw in this public education system. And I believe I've found it. Now, for this, I'm going to refer to another article. This one's by Connor Boyack and Corey DeAngelis. I'll put a link in the show notes when they publish, but it's called "Are Public Schools Broken or are the defects part of the design? And there's some very interesting points. I suggest you read them. But what's interesting is, he says, today's government schools were first designed in the mid-19th century with heavy contributions from Horace Mann, one of the leading education reformers in America. He was an admirer of the schooling system being developed in Prussia, featuring standardized curriculum, widespread testing, compulsory attendance, professionalization of teachers, and career training. It was an authoritarian top-down model that emphasized the collective over the individual. Does that sound familiar? Because it certainly describes the school system I grew up in. Again, I am a product of public schools. We had a standardized curriculum. There was lots of testing. There was compulsory attendance. The teachers went to school and had ongoing training to be professional teachers. Now, Mann was an advocate for implementing this type of schooling in America. And apparently his efforts were pretty successful. See, he was instrumental in getting Massachusetts to adopt the Prussian model of education statewide in 1852, and other states soon followed. What emerged in the years ahead was a new kind of school called the factory model school, where both the design of the school building and the processes used within it were modeled after an actual factory. It was a linear system moving students through standardized information, regulated process, and grade levels by age, akin to a conveyor belt process in a factory. I found that quote interesting because I remember jokes about how, let's face it, school systems are like a car factory. You bring the student in, you stick the headlights on, you pass them on to the next grade. Now, apparently Mann worked very hard to set up this framework, a foundation of a system for the factory model school. And he thought, you know, if I can get the framework in place, well, then other reformers can kind of pick up the ball and go with it. One of them happened to be a gentleman by the name of John Dewey. By the way, if you've ever taken any sort of course anywhere that involved the library system, and you've heard of the Dewey Decimal System, yeah, we're talking about that Dewey. Now, that Dewey happened to be a humanist with a belief in an atheist utopia, and he wrote in his book, My Pedagogic Creed, he says, I believe that every teacher should realize the dignity of his calling, that he is a social servant set apart for the maintenance of proper social order and securing the right social growth. I believe that in this way, the teacher always is the prophet of the true God and the usherer in of the true kingdom of God. Except Dewey's true kingdom of God was government. So the school system that he promoted, the school system he worked on, was designed and eventually built across the entire country, was to establish a group of people, to build up forces whose natural effect is to undermine the importance and uniqueness of family life. These academics, these secondary schools, they were designed for social transformation. And the key was to separate the child from the family. In fact, he said, the importance of public schools is the relaxation of older family ties. They want to weaken the ties between the child and their parents, to weaken that family relationship. But if you weaken that relationship, you have to replace it with something. What do you replace it with? Well, relation to and dependence on the state. In fact, a prominent official in the National Education Association in 1934 said, the major function of the school is the social orientation of the individual. It must seek to give him understanding of the transition to a new social order. Which brings me back to, what is the original problem? Is the original problem a public school system, a publicly funded system of education? Or is it a system that in the mid-1800s, turned those into factories to turn out students that were related to, bound to, dependent on government? In other words, to create socialists, to do what Vladimir Lenin said, give me your four-year-olds and in a generation, I will build a socialist state. Was that the goal of the modern public education system? If it was, then it's been a success. Which begs the original question that started my investigation. Is it time to separate school and state? Have we reached a point where government control of education is not simply detrimental, but it's crippling to the future of the republic? It is designed to undermine the republic and replace it with a socialist state, and it's taken generations to get here, but I have to wonder, why did it take so long? If Lenin was correct, then it would only take one generation of controlling the children to bring a socialist state. Why has it taken, 175 years now? From the 1850s, you got the 1950s, things were pretty stable for 100 years. In fact, even up to the 1980s, we had a very stable system that even with the educational system, even with the factory education, we didn't have this mess. There wasn't this cry for socialism, this march to socialism. What changed? I have a hypothesis, something for you to consider, and let me know if you think I've got it wrong. See, somewhere around the 90s, maybe late 80s, early 90s, there was a fundamental change in this country. Now, it kind of started the idea started in the 60s when it was determined that, well, the government was there to take care of people. And we started implementing in the 70s, this, the government would take care of this, and the government would provide welfare, and the government would provide health care, and we kept providing government housing, more and more government. But still, there was still some anchor, something preventing this fall towards socialism. I say that's the nuclear family. Because according to some stuff I've read, basically, through the 1980s, most households, American households, of all races and creeds, you had children in two-parent households. Now, I'm not saying that was always the case. That's always the case. Yes, there were one-parent households. There were divorce and early death. There's a lot of reason why that wasn't the case. But the norm, in other words, not only what was the most prevalent, but what was strived for was mom, dad, kids. What's the old, the American dream? Mom, dad, 2.5 kids, house with a white picket fence. That changed. Somewhere around the 90s, it seems, we were implementing policies that broke down the American family. Again, before 1980, out-of-wedlock births were a very small minority of the total. But since the 1990s, that number has risen to over 40% of all births. 40% are the people who are not married. And by the way, that's even higher among the Black and Hispanic communities, with 70% of Black households, Black births, and 51% of Hispanic births being to non-married families. In 2008, based on 2018 numbers, that breakdown of the family, I believe, was the crumbling of the dam that was holding back this move towards an all-power government and a socialist state. But think about it. That started in the 90s. Well, how long is a generation? I've seen it measured a couple. Of course, we have our own. We come up with, Gen Z and Gen X and baby boomers and all that. And they are generally about 15, 20 years in how they break it up that way, which is, I guess, what they refer to as a social generation versus a family generation, which is more like 20 to 30 years. But if that's the case, we see the 90s started this. And we are about a generation since we've seen this crumbling, and we're watching. We are seeing not the beginning of the crumbling of the of the Republic, the beginning of the takeover of the socialists. It's been going on for, about 10, 12 years now. Maybe Lenin was right. It's just they needed to not only take over the children in school, they needed to destroy the influence of the parents that protected them. That was the dam against this takeover. Now, I've got some examples of where we are and what's going on, but I need to take a break first. I hope you'll head to the website, constitutionstudy.com. And in fact, if you're interested, I've announced the Constitution Study Patriots. It's a program at the website that's designed to help people and organizations do what they do, but do it better. Give them more opportunities through things like education, communication, and activation. You can find out more. Go to constitutionstudy.com/patriots and find out more about that. There's still a lot going on. I'm still working on the boot camp. By the way, if you're willing to travel to Middle Tennessee, I'm still trying to set up a in-person boot camp somewhere around Independence Day in Bedford County. Look for the city of Shelbyville. If you're interested, again, go to the website, go to constitutionstudy.com, go to /bootcamp, and let me know. I need to know how big a venue I need to acquire, and that will help me. So you can find all the information there, again, at the website, constitutionstudy.com. Now, also, I hope you will check out Healthy Cell. They are a leading innovator in supplements designed to work at the cellular level to keep you healthy. Now, if you want to help support your immune system while you're on the go, well, why don't you try Healthy Cell's immune-boosting nutrients in the ready-to-go travel-ready gel pack called Immune Super Boost. It contains over a dozen immune supplements in that one gel pack, and I use it regularly. I throw it in my bag when I travel. Whenever I'm going to be around a lot of people and my immune system needs a bit of a kick, well, I reach for the Immune Super Boost. Now, as an America Out Loud listener, you can get 25% off your first order if you use the code OUTLOUD at checkout. So please go to HealthyCell.com, put your cart together. You can try the Immune Super Booster, any of the products from Healthy Cell. But use that code OUTLOUD at checkout. It lets them know that you listen to America Out Loud, and as a thank you, you get 25% off your first order.
In 2008, people could spend an average of 12 seconds on a task without becoming distracted. 5 years later, it was only 8 seconds. The digital age is narrowing our attention span. Trouble concentrating or recalling information is frustrating, embarrassing, and kills productivity. Advanced nutrition company, Healthy Cell, created Focus and Recall to boost your brain power. And unlike other supplements that don't work, Focus and Recall is not a pill. It's a patent-pending gel you swallow with ultra-absorption of science-backed ingredients to help you immediately sharpen focus, concentrate longer, and strengthen recall. These physician-formulated gels come in a small gel pack. Tear off the top, shoot it down. Thousands of 5-star reviews proves it works. Supercharge your brain and see the difference. Go to HealthyCell.com and use limited time code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. Risk-free. Love it or your money back. Guaranteed. HealthyCell.com. Code OUTLOUD.
Whether you're an independent, a Democrat, or a Republican, one thing remains true. Airborne viruses love us equally. You've all heard Malcolm and the great Dr. Peter McCullough talk about the advanced nasal solution Cofix RX. Cofix is made in the USA and recommended by thousands of doctors and pharmacists nationwide. Did you know that doctors and nurses have been swabbing their noses with povidone iodine to protect from airborne threats like colds, flus, and pandemic-era strains for decades? Cofix RX took that idea and made a more complete nasal formula with lasting cleansing effects. Maybe you're traveling soon or going to an event. Are you concerned somebody nearby might be sick? Maybe the office or classroom stresses you out. Get yourself a bottle of Cofix RX nasal solution. Spray goodbye to colds and flus with a Cofix RX nasal solution cleanse. That's COFIXRX.com. Save 20% by using promo code OUTLOUD at COFIXRX.com.
Hello, I'm Ben Marble, MD, and I founded MyFreeDoctor.com as a donation-supported, faith-based nonprofit with a mission to save lives by delivering free doctor visits to patients in all 50 states of America. MyFreeDoctor.com treats a broad range of health concerns like COVID-19, long COVID, sinus infections, urinary tract infections, rashes, medication refills, and more. So please visit MyFreeDoctor.com, where we're healing America one person at a time.
Welcome back, Everyday American Interview. Join the Constitution Study, and today we're asking, is it time to separate school and state? Have the allowing the government to take over the schools, what damage has it done? And I spent a good chunk of the first segment talking about the history and how we got here, but I want to give you some examples that the factory school that was created by Mann and Dewey was really designed to separate the child from the family. And that seemed to work really well it didn't work really well until we started seeing the rest of society break down the family. Once the family was no longer encouraged by society, once it was actually in some cases despised by society, actively attacked by society, that bulwark against socialism is crumbling. And now we're watching the schools being effective in separating the children from from their parents, from the family. For example, in Webster Grove School District in Missouri, a suburb of St. Louis, a student's parent asked permission to read a book, and the school approved the request. Sounds innocent enough until you realize the book is called I Am Jazz, and it is specifically a book promoting transgenderism to children. Oh yeah, there's one other little problem. See, because this deals with human sexuality, Missouri law requires the school to inform parents of this content and give them the opportunity to opt out, which they didn't. They didn't notify the parents. They didn't give them a chance to opt out. It reminds me of a situation I've mentioned before, many years ago when I had a parent, a distraught mother, who found out that her daughter had been exposed to age-inappropriate sexual material in the classroom. When she asked the principal why she was not given the opportunity to opt out, the principal said, well, we find if we let parents know, they tend to opt out. That's got to be getting close to 20 years ago now that incident happened. And here we are, and it's becoming more and more common. The school knows better than the parents, so we're just going to ignore the law? We're just going to ignore the law. Now, I'm really kind of curious as what's going to happen now. Now, this wasn't one parent that objected. There's several. And one of the parent activists who spoke on condition of anonymity said she was not surprised by the I Am Jazz incident. They said the culture among admin and staff is to promote diversity, equity, and inclusion at any cost. They cannot see the possible downside of educating our children on topics of sexual and gender ideology at such a young age. While the communications director for the Webster Grove School District said the district doesn't believe that it actually broke the law with the reading of I Am Jazz. He said, while we don't believe this violates law, we are aware of the situation and have appropriately addressed it. How? Mr. Duncan, the communicator, he didn't specify. Now, this school district with over 10 schools and more than 4,400 students has a history of pushing racial and gender ideology on children. In September, a high school librarian encouraged students to check out sexually explicit books from her list of commonly banned books, to even enter a raffle for a sweet prize. I have no idea what that would be. The school district has plans to include personal pronouns in like they and them in math problems, to hire certified teachers as math interventionalists to fight racism and gender bias in math. And the school can't even claim that there's a mandate from the state to provide sex education. It's not required in public schools. But yet this school district is promoting it in early elementary school. Where's the consequences? If these people broke law, where are the criminal charges? Where is the lawsuit? Not that that would make a long-term difference, but to prevent stuff like this from happening in the future. Where? Better yet, where are the hundreds of if there are 4,400 students, where are the hundreds of outraged parents demonstrating at this school board, working to get them ejected to make sure they never serve again? Where's the call for the immediate firing of the student, the teacher and the staff that allowed this to happen? That's what I want to know. Where? Are the parents sitting back and waiting for the state, which introduced most of this nonsense? I don't mean the state of Missouri. I mean the government. Where are they expecting the government to fix this? Those are your children, ladies and gentlemen. What are you doing to protect them? That's not the thing. All parents are sitting around. There's a school board meeting in Maryland that was packed. There were over 180 citizens packed in the auditorium. And according to the reporter, just based on the applause, they were none too happy with what's going on. One 30-something mother who took her small child out of public school said told the board that religious people like her are just as marginalized as trans kids. Sounds like maybe they're more marginalized than trans kids. She made a very interesting point. Her name is Kate Curtin. She said, the justification for adding gender ideology into the health curriculum is typically that we want to help a marginalized group. Transgender or non-binary to be included, have visibility in the curriculum, help others become tolerant, and to eliminate bullying. She goes, wasn't I part of the marginalized group being bullied? Shouldn't I have been protected by the school? Shouldn't the school have created a curriculum to help me be more included and others to be more tolerant? Isn't that interesting how the tolerance and inclusion only seems to go one way? Now, what's interesting is the board vice president, Dean Rose, tried to counter some of this criticism, pointing to a defense of their policy 443, which allows students to request staff that their gender identification be withheld from their parents. He said, every piece of case law in Maryland supports in whole policy 443. He went on to say, federal expansion of Title IX provides protection for transgender people, and that I hope everyone provides the same fervent advocacy in regard to gun violence. Well, Mr. Idiot Dean Rose, case law is not law. I'm not familiar with the Constitution of Maryland, but I know they have a separation of powers, and that legislative authority is given to the legislature, not the courts. By the way, the quote-unquote federal expansion of Title IX was done illegally. It was not done through the legislative process. It was a kingdom-like president who simply declared, because he said so, to expand this insanity. And as far as gun violence, how many schools do you know where the teachers are shooting the children? You're more worried about gun violence. How idiotic can you be? You're turning this around onto gun violence. Your teachers are... Careful, Paul. Your teachers are attacking their students. They are indoctrinating them with a lie that your sex can change just because you say so, that your gender can change because you feel like it, leading them to make dangerous and sometimes deadly decisions, mutilating their own bodies, taking drugs that will permanently make them infertile, and Lord knows what else. And you're worried about gun violence when it's your own teachers that are committing violence on these children. Probably a good thing I wasn't there, because that really would have set me off. Speaking of getting set off, there was a town called Riverton, Utah. And, let's just say there's an interesting clip. See, the mayor went to a school board meeting, and he made some very interesting points.
I'm here tonight to talk about an issue that I think has become pretty alarming, and unfortunately, I don't think is getting the attention that it deserves, and it's what Ken, Representative Irie, was just talking about, and that is inappropriate materials and pornographic material in schools. as mayor, really, I view it as my number one job to protect the health and safety of all of our residents. And I've heard from scores of residents about the concerns of inappropriate materials in schools. I receive emails, phone calls. To a large extent, I need to tell you, they feel like they are not being heard.
So here we have the mayor who's concerned. He's got people coming to him, parents coming to him, saying, we've got filthy material. We have pornographic material in the schools. And when they go to the schools, to the school board to deal with this problem, they feel like they're not heard. And this seems to be a trend. This seems to be something that's happening in a lot of schools and a lot of school districts across the country based on some of the news reporting I've heard. But he made one interesting point. I hadn't thought of it quite this way before, but I like the way he put it.
One issue that I've heard repeatedly is that the process it takes, one has to go through, is per school. And really what ought to happen is if one volume is found to be inappropriate in one school, it ought to be eliminated district-wide. I mean, we would never just ban somebody from a school that's dealing drugs or other harmful substance. We would lock them up. We would get them out of the district altogether. And that's what we need to do.
Interesting. So if they found someone providing harmful substances in school, they wouldn't simply remove them from that school. They'd remove them from the district. Yet we have staff, administrators, teachers bringing harmful content, pornographic content, in many cases, illegal content into the schools. And when a parent finally works through whatever process they have to go to get that stuff removed from one school, it's still available in the rest of them. Does this sound rational to anyone else? I suppose if you believe that people can change their genders simply by a wish and a prayer, maybe it does make sense. To the rest of us, not so much. Now, again, if this is what you want to do in your home, if the parents want this in their home, that's one thing. We're talking about a public school system, a government entity at this point, telling our students that 2 + 2 = 5, that up is down, left is right, that right is wrong. And too many of the parents, I think, are putting up with it. But what do we do, Paul? What do we do? Well, I've got some ideas, and I want to get to them a little later, but I'll tell you the one thing we do not do. We do not resort to violence. We do not initiate violence in order to get our way. But apparently, that's what some of the others are doing. According to reports from KTTV-TV in California, there was a brawl in a school. Now, what happened was a transgender student at a high school in Riverside, California, has assaulted a girl after exposing his genitals and spitting at girls in the girl's locker room. According to student witnesses, a transgender boy entered the girl's locker room and after being confronted for being there, spat on a group of girls and exposed his penis to them. He spit on my friends that are girls, females. He showed his genitalia in the locker room. A fight then ensued outside between the female victim and the transgender boy. The transgender student has now been removed from Riverside's Martin Luther King High School. Now, what I find interesting, and again, not in a good way, the video is amazing. The girl is a good 8 inches, 10 inches shorter than the guy. Forget the transgender nonsense. This is a dude. But she doesn't back down. She keeps coming at him. There's another video of a fight outside where I guess some transgender dude's trying to get inside the school and people are preventing him. And it turns into a brawl, a full-on brawl. Now, as I said, we should not initiate violence, But we should defend ourselves. And but this is what happens. Like, I'm going to get my way, and anybody that gets in my way, I'm just going to bully out of the way. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that's the mentality of the bully. That's the mentality of many, not all, many transgenders. How many? I don't know. What percentage? I don't know, and I'm not sure. But even for those who would not do this, who would not force their way into a locker room where they were not wanted because of their actual sex, these people make you look bad. What are you doing about it? I can understand the students defending the women, defending each other. Imagine you're in a ladies' locker room. Guys go in and you know, spitting and swinging. And I understand that. What I understand, what I don't understand is, where are the rest of the so-called transgender community that saying this is wrong and let's not have this stuff? I don't hear that. And that concerns me, because I don't know if the issue is just it's a large percentage of people who believe they can bully their way to get whatever they want, or if the bullies have bullied not only bullying everyone else, but they're bullying their quote unquote fellow transgenders as well to get their way. I'm not sure. I appreciate people who are willing to defend themselves and defend their friends. I think getting removed from school is maybe not all that should have happened. But again, this is wacky California. This is commie-fornia. Maybe we shouldn't at all be surprised. Now, I have to take another break. Before I go, though, I want to remind you, take an example from me. I make AmericaOutloud.com a daily stop for news and information every day. Why? Well, because the Constitution said he's just one voice here. There's a lot of different voices with a lot of different point of views, and we have a lot of great discussions on them. So it's important that we do our part, that we share the stories. We share the articles, the podcasts, the videos, all of this great information to expose other people to it who, if they listen to nothing but mainstream media, would never hear these things. So if you want to help secure the blessings of liberty, go to AmericaOutloud.com and share that information. Help other people see there is a way to live free and at liberty in America.
Here we take on the challenges of our generation so that we can preserve future generations. AmericaOutloud.com. 7 amazing years. We know that if America fails, the world will fail. It is incumbent upon us to carry the torch for liberty. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
The pandemic may be over for some, but millions of Americans are needlessly suffering from the long-haul effects of toxic spike protein from COVID-19 and the vaccines. You've heard Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company discuss the harmful effects of spike protein in your body, and now they found the solution. The miracle enzyme nattokinase. Their spike support formula contains nattokinase, the most compelling and scientifically supported approach to safely clear spike protein out of the body. What's more, spike support is optimized with other all-natural, non-GMO ingredients, like dandelion root, to help prevent spike protein from binding to your cells. Everyone should take daily spike support so you can feel your best. America Out Loud listeners can go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order.
You already know Genesis plus HOCL is your best defense against viruses. But did you also know it's the most powerful weapon for eliminating airborne mold too? Customers are raving about the Genesis Fogger's ability to tackle mold problems and the bad smells that go with them. And we all know mold is a hazard to your health. There's no airborne invader that Genesis can't handle. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud to receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you're ready for anything.
You Welcome back, Everyday Americans. You've rejoined the Constitution Study, and today we're talking about separation of school and state, education and state, getting the educational system out of the hands of government. Now, one of the things we find with many government entities is that public unions, well, they tend to take over. Because it is truly an incestuous relationship, right? Because these unions help elect the very people that are going to negotiate contracts with them, which to me is a clear conflict of interest. If you are on a school board and the union helped get you elected, you have a conflict of interest, but that's never stopped them in the past. Now there are other questions coming out about the lockdowns, the shutdowns of the schools during this scamdemic. There was, you know, Randy Weingarten, the president of the second largest teachers union, the American Federation of Teachers, was up on Capitol Hill. She was testifying before some subcommittee. And she was asked questions like, Americans are curious to know if the AFT, the American Federation of Teachers, access was in line with CDC past practices and if their influence had a positive or detrimental impact on America's children. They went on to say, while it is reasonable for the CDC to seek outside opinions, were some opinions accepted and others not, and why or why not? In other words, did this teachers union or the president, Randy Weingartner, suggest changes to the CDC's guideline documents about running K-12, which prolonged the school closure? There certainly is plenty of evidence for Ms. Weingarten promoting the idea of keeping the schools closed. There's video evidence all over the place, which makes me wonder, was Ms. Weingarten's desire to keep the schools closed because of her concern for the students, or to make sure that her teachers could still get paid to work from home? I don't know, but it certainly is worth investigating. And I'm not talking about the partisan political investigation on the Hill. I'm talking about a serious investigation about the decision-making by the CDC. Speaking of decision-making, how would you go about deciding, well, how good a job your school is doing? If you've got students in school, how do you rate them? How do you judge whether or not they're doing a good job? I mean, sure, we've had these, you know, we have had testing, we've had standardized testing, we've had, different things about testing students. But here's one I hadn't heard of before. First, a little bit of background. See, back in February, a report showed that not one in 55 Chicago public schools met the grade level expectation in either math or reading during the 2021-2022 school year. Not one. Now, that seems like it's pretty bad. If we're looking at the quality of a school, that's pretty bad. So the Chicago Board of Education, they wanted to do something. So just the other day, they voted 6-0 unanimously. They approved what they call the Continuous Improvement and Data Transparency Accountability Policy. Okay, what is this supposed to do? Well, apparently it grades the schools on a 5-point scale, but not simply on the graduation or the grade level achievement of their students. No. On how the school supports the students emotionally, how parents feel about their child's education, in addition to the student grades. Oh, I see. You can't pass the test, but you felt really good about it, so we'll give you a passing grade. Let's imagine we do that. When your son or daughter turns 16, take them down to the DMV, tell them they got to take the test to get a driver's license. Oh, you didn't pass the test, but you tried really hard. You considered the emotional support of the child. You tried really hard. So we're going to give the child a driver's license. They're not qualified to drive, but we'll give them a driver's license anyway. Let me ask you, how would you feel getting on an airplane if you know that the pilot didn't actually pass his qualifications to fly that aircraft, but he tried really hard? The school worked to support him emotionally. And his parents or his family were really felt good about his education. How do you feel about getting on that airplane? Well, how about this? An advisor for the policy by the name of John Easton at the board meeting said, "This is a soft accountability policy that could be a model for the nation." This, ladies and gentlemen, is the tyranny of low expectations. Rather than looking and saying, the school system is failing, let's do something to fix what the school system is doing, we're just going to change how we measure it so that the school system feels better. That's effectively what they're doing. This is the, you know, everybody wins. Everybody gets a trophy in the public school system, according to the Chicago Board of Education. See how it's not about educating our students? It's not making sure they can read. It's not making sure they can do math. It's about making sure the school district can say, well, we've got schools that have met a level because, well, they can't read and write, but they feel good. So if they're not being taught reading and writing, what are these children being taught? Well, a school district in Pennsylvania announced a partnership with the largest teachers union. What are they going to do? Well, they're going to launch an LGBTQ initiative. They're going to give teachers ally badges to that provide resources to gay students. The North Sun Area School District launched the what they call an I'm Here initiative. It was created by the National Education Association's LGBTQ Caucus, and it's designed to provide teachers and faculty these pride flag badges. And it's meant to they have QR codes so that students can scan them and get, well, websites promoted by the NEA's LGBTQ caucus. Because obviously that's more important than teaching math and reading and writing and science. And we got to make sure that we give them their LGBTQ indoctrination. Now, I've talked a lot about teachers and staff, and I want to make a point very, 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 very clear. I understand not all of them are accountable to this nonsense. Not all the staff and not all the teachers are on board with it. They are stuck in a system that's designed to push them this direction. But there are those that stand. I've known some wonderful teachers in my life. I've had some really good teachers in my life. And I want to point out when, well, they do the right thing. Like two middle school teachers in California that are suing their school district. Why? Because the school district has a policy that requires them to hide the student's gender identity from the parents. That's right. This is not parents filing a suit. These are teachers. Elizabeth Maribelli and Lori Ann West, who teach at the Rincon Middle School in Escondido, California, filed suit against the Escondido Union School District and the California State Board of Education over this policy. They argue that the policy, which hides information about the child's identity from the parents, is unconstitutional. It also violates their right to freedom of religion and freedom of speech. Now, they claim it's a First Amendment right, but it's technically a California constitutional right, but that's not my point. You've got teachers. Yeah, I think about it. I've had some really, really good teachers. How about we take these teachers that are standing up to do the right thing, that are standing up to do what they think is right, and we support them? Because far too often, I think that does not happen. And I think that's part of the problem. When you see teachers standing up to do the right thing, too many parents don't do anything about it. They're more than happy to complain when they do something wrong, but they're not willing to stand with them when they do something right. But then there are those that, well, they don't want to hear what's right. They don't want that the students exposed to that. And it's not just at the primary and secondary level. It's at higher education. See, at the University of North Carolina, 673 professors at UNC Chapel Hill signed a public letter that they are opposing legislation that would require students in the university to take courses on American government and founding documents. Now, granted, this is the Constitution study. All we do is teach people the Constitution and about how America's government's designed. And now, if you go to UNC, the professors, they don't want you to teach this. Now, the legislation in question is House Bill 96. It would require students to take a 3-credit-hour course covering America's founding and history. Required reading for the course would include the U.S. Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, the Emancipation Proclamation, 5 essays from the Federalist Papers, the Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail, and the Gettysburg Address. Now, the professors argued that this legislation violates core principles of academic freedom, substitute ideology force-feeding for the intellectual expertise of faculty. Well, it do have a certain point of view, right? But they kind of got it backwards. In other words, it's saying if you are going to be a U.S. citizen, shouldn't you know a little bit about, well, what your responsibilities are? What the government can and cannot do? I wouldn't mind, by the way, if they added maybe some essays from the Anti-Federalist Papers as well, but I understand. But what does it tell me about the teachers, the professors, that they do not want this taught? They don't want the Constitution taught in their university. They don't want the Declaration of Independence. They don't want the Federalist Papers taught. They don't want the Gettysburg Address taught. And just to show how racist they are, they don't want the Emancipation Proclamation, Dr. King's letter from a Birmingham jail taught either. Now, while we're dealing at the college level, A group of professors that were involved in developing the College Board's Advanced Placement African American Studies course, well, they complained internally that the board was forcing changes to the curriculum and bowing to political pressures from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. Well, I found that rather interesting, because while they are complaining about the influence of one state governor, they're kind of ignoring the fact that the political pressure they were, quote unquote, bowing to was a Florida law that, as Florida government officials pointed out, said, we don't want courses such as Black Queer Studies and post-racial racialism, colorblindness, Afrofuturism in these advanced placements. In other words, don't teach sex in an African-American studies. But you see, the professors, the members of the board here, they're not happy with that. They want to promote whatever they want, which gets me back to one other point that I want to mention before we go, and that is the tyranny of experts. See, I've been working on the boot camp that I want to give a little later this year. If you want to find out more, go to constitutionstudy.com/bootcamp. And one of the foundational points I make is that an expert opinion is still just an opinion. Just because you're an expert doesn't mean you're not wrong. And I think we've become so indoctrinated with the idea that you listen to the experts, that we don't challenge what the experts say, leads us to this point. So as I look back as how did we get here, so we figure out what to do, we watched while the experts told us that we weren't teaching kids right, that we needed a factory model. The experts told us that you had to have professionals, experts that decide what to teach your children, and we need to keep the parents out of it. Experts that decide what information a parent does and does not to be aware of. Experts telling us that, you know, we don't need to worry about the grades as long as people feel okay. And experts that say we don't want to teach things like the actual supreme law of the land, the founding of this country. And we certainly don't want them to teach that African-American studies unless we're teaching about, you know, Black queer studies and other sexualized topics. See, that's the problem with the experts. Experts are wrong. Experts are wrong in so many things. But what we've done is we, the people, have handed over our children to experts, and then we stopped paying attention. We stopped being involved in their education. When I was in fifth grade, this is back in the 1960s, late 60s, thank you, my mother volunteered at our public school in New York City. She showed up, 3 days a week to help just to help the teacher. She was involved. Granted, that was pretty rare. But we still had regular meetings where the parents were engaged with the teaching. And we've lost that. We've allowed the experts to take over. And now the experts are not simply, they're deciding what is best. They're isolating the parents. They're further destroying the bedrock of our republic. The idea that in order to be individually free, to be at liberty, family is the best support. They're the ones you go to when you need help, when you need advice, when you need assistance. Not the government, not some bureaucrat, family. If family can't help, well, go to the church. If the church can't help, then maybe you consider government. But our experts have told us we need to go government first. Government only. And we're looking at the consequences. Now, obviously, probably the best thing you do is get your children out of public school. In fact, I'd suggest get them out of school completely. Teach them at home. But I know that's not possible for millions of Americans. What I would say is make sure you are engaged, you're involved, that you realize you are in charge of your child's education, not the school district, not the teacher, not the expert, you. And you make sure they know it. And when they push back, you push harder. You get friends, you get family to stand so that the family is the one that controls the education, not the state. And that will be our first step in separating school from state. And I hope you'll bring some friends and join me every weekday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time for the Constitution Study right here on America Out Loud Talk Radio, heard on the iHeartRadio Network. If you can't listen then, all my episodes go to podcast generally a day or two after they're heard on talk radio, and you can hear them on your favorite podcast app. But do me a favor, subscribe, leave a rating and review. It helps other people find the Constitution Study as well. And you can find all the links to the homepage at AmericaOutLoud.com. But please, pretty please, share them. Let other people know we're out here. Let other people know there's another voice to listen to. And by doing so, you share not only the Constitution Study, but the blessings of liberty.